to address before allowing the TNCs to operate, and also if the taxi cab companies are adopting similar disclaimers with CURB, I think we need to look at that too. I mean, it seems to me that normal tort liability rules should apply, and that's something I want to address before we have any resolution go forward.
It also says on page 6, Uber does not guarantee the quality, suitability, safety, or ability of third-party providers. You agree that the entire risk arising out of your use of this services and any service or good requested in connection with these services remains solely with you. That's...
I agree.
I feel like I'm... that Uber should be paying me by the hour right now. I have a few things... I guess I have a few comments on that. First of all, this is the user agreement between Uber and the passenger. If the passenger were in an accident and they sued both Uber and the driver would be covered under as an insured under the policy that Uber carried, the commercial policy that Uber carries. So the insurance would kick in. Now, beyond the insurance limits, Uber is disclaiming liability in these, and I keep pointing out, I always feel bad about this, but I should say Uber and Lyft and Curb are disclaiming liability. I'll say a few things about that. Under Oregon law, these kind of limitations of liability and releases, I believe, are unenforceable and unconscionable as a matter of law. And we recently had a case from the Oregon Supreme Court, Bagley versus Mount Bachelor. You might have heard about it in the news that held as much. I would think that at first blush, they would have a hard time enforcing this limitation of liability, the company. And I'll take that a step further. You know, that was a ski resort. This is what the Oregon Supreme Court has previously defined as, or I would define as, an essential public service, which they had already said limitations of liability don't apply to. So in and of itself, I think this limitation of liability is unenforceable under Oregon law.
Hold that for thought for a second. What's an equivalent area of the law we regulate where we allow someone to put a clause into an agreement, a commercial agreement that we regulate, where we say it's probably not enforceable, but we'd let them do it anyway? And I'm thinking about restrictive covenants in land deeds. I'm thinking about certain kinds of restrictive covenants on where you can work after the fact, all kinds of things. Where is there an example where the city, having knowledge of a clause which we think is legally unenforceable, nonetheless allows that to be put into an agreement in a regulatory situation? And particularly in an instance where there's such an imbalance between the power of the TNC and the average customer. Because the point of these kinds of provisions is to discourage people from exercising their rights, because they read this and it says, you know, we've got you over a barrel. Now we're assuming someone has access to a lawyer, quality advice, has the time, the resources to pursue it, and can get a ruling from a court that is not enforceable, which is just gets you the front door of then pursuing your negligence claim. And I can't off the top of my head think of many examples where the city knowingly allows someone that we regulate to put a clause into an agreement with a customer that we think is legally defective.
I don't know that I can think of one off the top of my head either.
Uber's no longer paying your fees. You just strayed.
I can't think of one off the top of my head either. I guess the counter argument to that, and I don't want to draw the ire of Commissioner Novick, is I don't know in a regulatory capacity many areas where we get involved in the contracts between citizens and companies. Now, maybe you can think of one.
Remember, as the mayor will remind us, this is a new technology. And it's new territory. The reason we're having this conversation is we're all kind of making it up. But, for example, as the comment I made last week about the Americans with Disabilities Act, you know, these platforms take the position that they are not covered by the ADA. And they make very sharp legal claims. They say they're not public accommodations. They're not transportation service providers. They're just internet matchmakers. And therefore, if you've got a problem under the ADA, go somewhere else. And by the way, the people they are working with on their platforms are independent contractors, so they don't even have the traditional employer-employee relationship. I would say that is a very well and artfully crafted legal relationship if you want to inoculate yourself from any of the liability of your business model. But I think the question we have to grapple with is, from a public interest point of view, is that something we want to ratify?
To put it bluntly, do we want to even have the possibility that if Uber knowingly hires an axe murderer and he chops me up, that they can say the most that they'll be liable for is $500?
Do I want to address that one? Well, I would say a couple things, and this, aside from what I've already said about my belief in the unenforceability of these limitations of liability, if you were to put something into code that said that you can't have this as a condition of being permitted, I haven't done enough research to know that we can do that, and there's not some kind of preemption there, federal preemption or some kind of constitutional claim. So I'll say that at the outset. And I think that our ability to do that would only affect users who agree going forward, not people who have already agreed to the terms of service before the effective date of whatever we do. So I do think it's, you know, as Commissioner Fish pointed out, we are in a new landscape, and this is in some ways uncharted territory.
And a question that I asked Mr. Bagheera to look into is, would we be better off putting something in code saying that this kind of provision is unenforceable, or do we need to get the TNCs to agree up front in a contract with us that these provisions are not enforceable in the city of Portland? So I would suggest that we go with whichever option is that our lawyers recommend is the most usable.
Well, if we put it in code that it was unenforceable, I mean, ultimately that's up to a court to decide whether it's unenforceable or not. So
well, in this case, it might not even be a court that decides that question if a court determines that everything's subject to mandatory arbitration. So you may actually have an arbitrator in a proceeding that doesn't have an appeal right to a court deciding the legal question, and that also bothers me.
Okay.
So I have some more questions. First of all, thank you to Lyft for providing their user agreement in a font that I can actually size big enough for me to read. I'm reading in their agreement, it is up to the driver or vehicle operator to decide whether or not to offer a ride to a rider. And so that will play into, I know we're going to get to the ADA questions shortly, but that seems questionable to me. There's an article here, a paragraph about donations. Are we a donation market or are we a charge market in Lyft? That's on page 3 of
29. Yeah, that I don't know. I tried to click on that link and it didn't take me anywhere, so I don't know what a donation market is.
So that's another question for our next work session. And then they have a cancellation fee. So presumably at the end of this, we're going to have both sides come up and
sure.
Give us
yeah, and acknowledging the time, yeah.
Okay. The cancellation fee under Lyft, in the event that a rider cancels a ride request on the Lyft platform more than 5 minutes after such a request is made, rider agrees to a cancellation fee of $5. So if you're in an underserved area and you've been waiting for 30 minutes and you decide, forget it, I'm going home, there's still a $5 fee. Is that correct?
If a driver has accepted the ride request already, right?
No, it's the request. The rider makes a request.
Why don't we let the company answer the company questions after we let our staff answer the questions that we asked our staff?
Well,
let's get through these first and then go to those company questions. We get the folks up.
All right.
And actually, I think that we're ready to move on to talk about accessibility and the ADA. And I think maybe Ken can really briefly talk about the legalities of the ADA as they pertain to taxis and TNCs, and then we can talk about the practical commitments that the TNCs and requirements that we would impose on taxis and TNCs.
So I believe the question was asked whether the city believes that TNCs are subject to Title III of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and I just want to unequivocally say, yes, we do, and we rely on the position of the Office of Civil Rights, or the Civil Rights Division of the United States Department of Justice, who is the governmental entity charged with enforcing the Americans with Disabilities Act. The U.S. Department of Justice has taken the position in two cases recently, one in Sacramento, or in San Francisco, stemming from Sacramento, and one in the Western District of Texas in San Antonio, where the TNCs have argued that they are not subject to Title III of the Americans with Disabilities Act. The Department of Justice says you're subject either as a public accommodation or as a transportation service provider under the statute and the regulations. And in at least one of the cases, the one in Texas, the judge agreed on a motion to dismiss, which means that they will go forward with a trial based on facts and law as to whether they're subject to Title III of the ADA. From my perspective, the city considers them subject to the Americans with Disabilities Act, and our code requires that transportation for hire companies comply with all applicable federal law. If we were to receive a complaint that they had in some way discriminated based on disability, we would pursue fines, suspension of their permit, or revocation of their permit. Ultimately, we would have to go to the code hearings office and make the claim of A, why they're subject to Title III. The same arguments will be made there that were made in San Antonio and San Francisco, and B, that the facts of the particular incident was a violation of Title III.
So, colleagues, anybody in America, a corporation or an individual, has a right to assert a defense in a legal proceeding. So they certainly have the right to argue that Title III of the ADA doesn't apply, even if the Justice Department disagrees. They have the right to draft a user agreement that contains language which our council thinks is illegal and unenforceable. They have the right to take a lot of positions, and the reason this is especially relevant to me is that at some point it becomes a predictor of behavior once we regulate the activity. And so my two concerns are: a company that says they're not covered by the ADA, are we sure that we have a firm commitment to provide equality of service to disabled customers? And a company that's taken some fairly sharp legal positions, are we sure we're going to get the data that Commissioner Novick requires to test this period? And if there's any doubt about that, I think the council would probably support you, Steve, in making it very clear at the certification phase in writing what the obligation is in terms of data sharing.
Which we will. And Commissioner, I actually think that one thing we need to do with regard to accessibility is establish a standard of service from the get-go, not just have a general promise that they will contract for accessible services, but I think that we will need to have an actual standard of service, such as has been suggested by Sue and Peep, and say something along, I mean, I'm just making this up, but something along the lines of the average wait time for people requesting accessible service shall not be more than X more than the average wait time for everybody else.
I thought
it was
the same.
Well, right. We could talk about that. I mean, the cab companies right now aren't providing anywhere near that.
We would make it the same for everybody.
Should make it the same for everybody, certainly.
And particularly during the pilot program, I think it's important to establish the benchmark, establish that performance standard to specifically state that wheelchair accessible vehicles who do not respond within a comparable amount of wait time, you know, within perhaps 20 minutes, kind of along the lines of Commissioner Novick's suggestion, you know, that is a very specific and enforceable performance measure.
Brian, in this materials, we're talking about period one, period two, period three, and there's a period before you've actually been matched with a car, and it and I honestly don't know the answer to this question. Do you measure standard of service from the time the call is made to request service, or from the time that the taxi company, the TNC, actually matches your call to a service?
city code currently defines it as the point at which a customer requests a service.
So it's really upstream at the that's I think that's a better standard because you have so little control over when your order is matched with a taxi or another vehicle.
Right. It's also important though that the customer is actually getting through to dispatch. So in the case of like a telephone-based dispatch, we need to ensure that the customer is actually connecting to the dispatch. For app-based dispatch, it's much easier to ensure that ride requests are being serviced. And to your questions, Commissioner Fish, about any commitments or reluctance from sounded like TNC specifically is in your mind about providing accessible service and sharing data. We have that commitment from both Uber and Lyft, and I think that it's an important point that council asked directly to those companies, and they're here today to provide that response.
And also that we have the chance, you know, during the pilot project period to have a work session and see how we're doing. I mean, I don't think we should go, you know, 90 days and then look backwards. We should go 30 days and check in.
I believe that a local sage once said measure twice,
right.
Something about... Right. Cut once.
Okay. Well, one thing that is, I think, a very promising and exciting partnership that Uber and Lyft are committed to is their partnership with First Transit, which is a national company, and then a locally well-renowned and respected company nonprofit organization called Ride Connection, who is very well connected to the disability community and has a good understanding of kind of the logistics and requirements to provide quality accessible service.
That like Ride Connection has a certain amount of capacity and it's almost maxed out with its current agreements. How do we ensure that there's the additional capacity to honor the commitment that the TNCs are making?
I think that's where having a standard of service comes in. I mean, the standard of service would not say, as long as you can achieve this with your agreement with Ride Connection, it would simply be, this is the standard of service, and you have to figure out a way to meet it one way or another.
Wouldn't that tend to make all of the service, everybody be worse off? If there are more people being referred to Ride Connection, as Commissioner Fish said, they're currently maxed out with providing accessible service. If there'll then be an influx of non-accessible vehicles via Uber, which is going to further create stress on the accessible system without any additional resources.
There's another possibility mentioned at the hearing, which we ought to hear from the TNCs about, which was that they would, in addition to, whether I don't know if it's in addition to or in lieu of, but maybe it's in addition to these options, that they would refer some of those calls over to taxi cab companies.
Right, but the problem is that there's not enough accessible vehicles now.
Well,
so
right,
then we're going to widen the gap. And as I've been concerned about all along, we're going to have one system for people with disabilities and older women and another system that works better for other people.
Now, the benefit of adding more for-hire transportation operators to the city of Portland is that we're actually expanding the opportunities for transportation options for everybody and transportation options for people with disabilities.
Not if there are no more accessible vehicles.
Again, we're looking for the opportunity to add that capacity to our current system. We know that the transportation options for people with disabilities is currently limited.
So this was something we were hoping to get more information on. How is the capacity? If the capacity of the system now is almost at maximum to the extent that we have 3-hour waits because the person who was driving that cab that day was not able to drive their cab, how is there's no proposal on the table for increasing the capacity?
Lyft and Uber do have a proposal on the table as part of their partnerships with First Transit and Ride Connection. I can speak generally about that, but they are also here and available to go into depth about that.
Let's get them up and answer that question.
But the point is, the Ride Connection is at capacity.
Well, so but if Ride Connection were at capacity, I assume they wouldn't contract with Uber and Lyft to provide additional rides.
Well, let's get them up and answer that question rather than make Brian answer that question.
So moving on to compliance.
Before you move on, you skipped over having the risk manager answer the question that we asked, number 17. And I believe the question was asking our city risk manager, should we require insurance coverage the same as livery services?
Apologies for going over that. Kim McGarry has been in touch with Kate Wood.
Thank you.
And Deborah Leopold Hutchins as well, who's an insurance expert. I'm not sure what the question is. The risk management staff was involved with the task force and believes that for any commercial general policy or commercial auto policy that we're named as an additional insured and that we have indemnification under those policies, I don't think they have a recommendation as to the limits one way or the other that we require of the TNC companies. And I don't mean to speak for Kate, but we met yesterday. Other than to say that Kate's job is to manage liability for the city, and she and I talked about that and agreed that, you know, to the extent that we're imposing on ourselves duties and requirements, we have obligations there to ensure that we're not negligent in what we're doing as a regulatory body. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, is Kate here? Because I think the question was about the city's liability.
Well, I can answer that. As to your liability for establishing some threshold that the companies have to meet, first of all, I better channel the torts lawyers in our office and say the city can always be named in a lawsuit. It's whether we're liable or not. So we would have legislative immunity from whatever we decide the limits are going to be. Again, where our liability would come into play would be a failure to monitor if we knew of a particular risk and did nothing, knew of a particular driver, for example, who didn't have any insurance. If we had some kind of foreseeable knowledge and we failed in our monitoring capacity or enforcement capacity to do anything about it.
And if we allow these, do we have liability from allowing these platforms to start up without having everything in place?
Well, I don't think that's the proposal on the table. We are going to have a process in place that requires them to comply with public health, safety, and welfare requirements. So I would answer no.
I think it's fair to say we'll be named in a lot of the early cases regardless, because a decent lawyer is not going to waive a potential claim until the courts have sorted this out. So we will likely be a defendant. Whether we are actually liable is something that will get sorted out.
We get named defendant as a defendant a lot, and the torts attorneys do a good job of getting us out of those cases. And somebody said, oh, they'll name the city of Portland because they're the deep pockets. And my wife said, I don't know about being the deep pocket between Uber and the city of Portland. So,
as somebody who had a process server interrupt my staff meeting yesterday, I can vouch that we're sued all the time.
Okay. Section 4, compliance. So there were some questions about rate and pricing. There was certainly discussion about whether or not the city should deregulate fares for TNC, but not deregulate for taxis, or should there be a total deregulation on all fares. Commissioner Novick, is this something that you want to kick off the discussion?
I think I said last week that this is one area where I disagreed with the task force. I think that if the fare regulations should exist or not exist for everybody, we shouldn't have fare regulations for the taxi cabs and not for the TNCs for any period of time.
And there is an explanation of surge pricing. Commissioner Fish had a specific question about that.
And by the way, just to Steve's point first, if you regulate taxis, but you deregulate TNCs, and given the data you've given us that says that, for example, Lyft has a $5 minimum price, what you're really doing is effectively saying that some of the least profitable rides, that is the rides that you have to travel the farthest, and then once you pick someone up, you travel the shortest distance, so it's Mrs. Smith who wants to go two blocks to the grocery store and come back, that those would not be done by TNCs, they would be done by cabs. Those are not profitable rides. That seems somewhat unfair. To Steve's point, if you're going to deregulate, maybe treat the both the same, although there may be unintended consequences of that as well. Do you, Commissioner Novick, have any concern generally with the various minimum prices that are built into TNCs and how that impacts the market?
I think that within a competitive market, you have various entities offering various terms, And if they're losing business because, I mean, they can lose business because they have a minimum which some people aren't willing to pay. So, I mean, the question is whether we, I mean, I think that it's worth, given that we normally don't regulate prices at all, and we've regulated prices in this industry for decades, I think it is worth seeing what happens when you deregulate prices and see what the impact is on consumers, and then reevaluate at the end of the experimental period.
And the TNC that advertises perhaps they have no minimums might have a competitive advantage.
Exactly.
I do just want to note there is a slight typo in the fares for Uber. They are more consistent with the Lyft rates, and we will provide corrected fares for Uber to council and to the public after this work session. For the permitting process, the TNCs, per the task force recommendations, would be getting a company permit, which is subject to full compliance with all of the city's requirements. The TNCs would be certifying that their drivers and the driver's vehicles are, again, in full compliance. The TNCs would be providing a weekly driver list to the city of Portland, PWAT staff would be verifying and auditing to ensure that everything is checking out in 100% compliance with our standards. The fiscal impact of TNC's Commissioner Fritz, and I think several members of council actually had questions about the business license and business license tax revenue that the city anticipates being collected. And Terry Williams from Revenue is here to actually cover this issue. Terry. And so as she comes up, the TNCs and all independent contractors, so the drivers for TNCs and taxis, are required to register to obtain a business license. For the drivers who are considered independent contractors, they are assessed a tax based, and actually, why don't we just have Terry accurately describe all of these details.
Okay. So anybody operating a business in the city of Portland needs to register with the Revenue Division and potentially pay a tax. Registration can be done online, and then at the annual tax is when you would determine if, based on your business receipts, whether you qualify for an exemption and don't actually pay the tax, you still have to file, or if you file and actually pay the tax. So that would be for the companies, provided that we have nexus with them. And that would also be for drivers operating a business in that way as well. So,
Terry, what does it mean to operate in Portland, particularly in a business model where you may actually live in Beaverton, do a lot of your rides in the metro area, but occasionally come into Portland? How much contact do you have to have with Portland to be covered by our business license fee requirement?
Okay, there is, since this is a service that's being provided, we do have a minimal standard. So if you come in to Portland less than 10 times in a year, or if your gross receipts from that service is less than $2,500, then you would be considered de minimis. And again, you file and you'd be exempt and you wouldn't pay anything. But anything over that, then you've got nexus. That's kind of a minimal standard on the business taxes.
And is the tax on the gross receipts or on the net income?
The tax is on the net income. The measure for exemption is based on gross receipts. The actual tax calculation is based on net income, so that would be after all of your expenses. So somebody who grosses less than $50,000, everywhere, just not Portland, but everywhere, they would not pay anything. It doesn't matter what their net income was. Someone whose gross receipts everywhere is more than $50,000, then that just says that you need to file and pay, and then you calculate that based on all of your expenses, your apportionment, if you're doing business both inside and outside the city of Portland, come down to, we have a minimum tax of $100. If you are very profitable, you'll pay more than that minimum tax.
So Uber collects all the money and for the ride, right, and then sends 80% back to the driver. Mm-hmm. The driver then deducts, you know, their mileage costs or whatever, and probably are not going to get up to $50,000 a year. So that 80% is essentially not going to be taxed by us. And then the 20% that Uber keeps, what's the, is that right, what I just said?
maybe. So let me make sure I walk through. Okay, so the 100% is going initially. You'll have to forgive me. I don't know their model, so I'm a little unsure, but I'll try to go on what you said. So that initially goes to Uber, and that's the gross receipts that Uber's going to show. So that's going to measure their if they qualify for exemption or not. So that's the first measure, and it has nothing to do with the expenses. So we'll assume that all of the rides that they're pulling in is going to be more than 50,000, so they're not exempt. So then to do the calculation, first they'll get their net income, and so that will be the 80% that goes back out to the drivers is a deductible expense that they'll show to get down to their profit. And then again, they'll do an apportionment based on what's here or not, so that will bring it down even more. And so it's that net income then that would potentially be subject.
So then it's on the 20% less their expenses. And yes. What's the tax rate on that 20%?
For the city of Portland, if you are more than the minimum of $100, it's 2.2% of that net income.
And do we have any data from other cities as to how much revenue we can expect from this?
We did not survey other jurisdictions for the revenue collected by their business licenses.
The situation is actually not that unusual for us in that we have businesses like UPS, right, that are giant national corporations that do some business here, right?
Yes, absolutely. Apportionment is a factor of all businesses that operate here and in other states. So this is our normal, typical calculations that you would do, and for us, for any business that you're operating, not just this particular one.
And particularly applicable to the cab companies as well.
Yeah. Right. So my concern is on a fiscal basis for the city of Portland, if the cab companies get fewer rides, then we get less tax from them. I'd like to know how much tax are we expecting to get from the TNC companies. And that was part of the discussion for Airbnb and the home sharing. So I'd like to know the fiscal impact of this, particularly when you get to the next bit about permit fees.
Right, and it's certainly difficult to determine that. For Airbnb, they had established commercial activities occurring here in Portland. For Uber and Lyft, they are not currently operational. So we can have a much better understanding of how much business tax revenue the city can anticipate if and when we permit TNCs.
Commissioner, it seems to me that unless Uber is less profitable, unless the TNCs are less profitable than the taxi companies, then even a shift of business, if there is one, from the taxi companies to the TNCs will not reduce our revenues. It would only be if the TNCs are low profit and the taxi cabs are high profit that a shift would reduce our revenues.
I'd like to see that analysis because there's the issue of taxi drivers being full-time, hopefully are making $50,000 a year and then are paying business income tax on that, whereas most of the Uber drivers. So it's because you've got many small drivers rather than a fewer number of full-time drivers. That's where we would get less money.
I wish that I thought that was a greater risk than I think it is. Given that we've heard that the average taxi cab driver makes $6.22 an hour, I fear that not many of them are making $50,000.
So I'd like to know from other
companies. I'd like to know from other cities of comparable size what revenue impact there has been.
So we want to certainly be respectful of council's time, but still address all the questions and concerns that were raised at last week's hearing. So moving on, there is recourse for passengers. The city already has an established complaint line, phone number, online form, and email address for anybody to log a complaint. That information is provided under answer number 32. We discussed the business license.
But then what's the outcome? So currently, if there's a complaint against a particular taxi cab driver, that's investigated, the company is fined or whatever, what would be the outcome for either a driver driving without a permit or for some other complaint? Who is going to then be investigated and fined?
So again, Portland PBOT staff do the investigation, and every investigation is unique. We have defined penalties for specific offenses already in city code, in addition to fiscal penalties that the city is able to impose, we also have the ability to revoke permits, and we also have the right to pursue criminal charges.
So, but it's the driver, right? So Uber, so we wouldn't revoke, would we revoke Uber's permit for one unpermitted driver?
It depends on the actual incident. We do have a track record in dealing with taxi companies. There are oftentimes individual drivers who are assessed a penalty based on their actions and decisions, but that doesn't necessarily translate to a penalty to the company. It's all dependent on the individual incident.
That's because the individual taxi cab drivers have permits, so that you can revoke just that one. If it's an unpermitted Uber driver, what's the responsibility of the platform to be liable for complaints?
If an individual TNC driver was not compliant with all of our requirements, that driver would have to be taken off a TNC's platform.
But that's not very much of a penalty. That's no penalty. That's just that person got found out and tossed off the list. There's no real impact to the company or to the service.
No, in addition to being kicked off the platform, if they were out of compliance, they would also be subject to a penalty based on the infraction, and then based on the severity of the particular details of an individual incident, a company could be subject to a penalty as well. There was a question about EcoCab as a recently permitted company. The task force has outlined and has a goal of creating parity for all taxi and TNC companies. There are some distinct differences in all of those requirements, which we heard from the task force last week. If there are any specific questions, we certainly like to field those at this time. Otherwise, we'd like to move on to the fee section. So, our goal for permitting fees is to calculate all fees on true cost recovery for the administration of the private for hire transportation program. We have done some calculations of cost recovery fees, and we are refining those. As it currently stands, we are not fully assessing cost recovery for taxi fees, so we anticipate completely overhauling the permitting fees and the process for all private for hire operators within the city of Portland. We do have a proposed 120-day pilot permit process and fee, with the goal of cost recovery, and we anticipate significant changes to all permitting process and fees in that phase two of the task force scope of work. We have addressed some data reporting. We do have a commitment from the TNCs that they will provide data. In your packet, we have outlined the types of data that the city is interested in receiving from not only the TNCs, but also the taxis.
And Brian, on that point, you're number 37. Is it the city's intent to get that commitment in writing prior to issuing any certification?
What we would like to do is sign individual data sharing contracts with every permitted taxi and TNC company, both so that we can affirm a individual commitment from each company, but also to guarantee that we're protecting proprietary information from each company.
But the point would be we would have that agreement in place prior to the permit?
Yes, contingent upon a permit.
I appreciate the qualification you used about, protecting proprietary information, but I'm a little nervous about that because I think these internet operators take a very expansive view of what is covered under that rubric. For example, with the short-term rentals, they claim proprietary information includes the host.
I think the key point is collecting and analyzing this data in aggregate form, so we're not getting individual passenger and driver data, if that makes sense.
Well, that's one set of data requirements, but earlier we said that we are going to require them to furnish us weekly with a list of drivers. So,
right, that's more of the compliance in a way that we can verify that drivers and vehicles are compliant with all of our city requirements.
And Commissioner, I mean, Airbnb, as you point out, didn't want us to know who the hosts are. The TNCs have agreed that we will know who their drivers are.
So are the taxi companies already collecting this data?
They are not necessarily collecting all of this data that's outlined in your packet. We do require that they log. There's two pieces of data that we require that they track. They are not required to report it to the City of Portland on a regular basis. They are required to produce that information upon request. And the data that we do require, I believe, and Michael and Ken are pulling this up right now, is really just, actually, I'm not even, we'll have them definitively explain the data that the taxis are required to collect.
So while they're finding that, my concern is that it seems like we're going to be having an administrative burden on the taxi companies with additional data collection for possibly no benefit to the taxi companies. It's obvious why Uber and their passenger, their drivers would agree to do this, because then they're going to hopefully get, they'd like to get to yes on being allowed to operate. It seems like this is an additional burden on the taxi companies.
It's a burden on the taxi companies, but the purpose of collecting the information is to know what the quality of service is the city for customers and use that information to develop future regulations. And I think that that's a powerful public interest.
We should do that as prospectively as the system is now, so that we have a baseline before we deregulate, and there's no telling whether the data that the taxi companies collect during the trial period is similar to what it currently is.
So first off, the data that the taxi companies are required to collect are date and time of initial reservation and initial and destination addresses. Commissioner Fritz, are you recommending that taxis not collect and report the data that is outlined in the packet for you?
If we're going to do a pilot, we need a baseline before we do the pilot, because otherwise just saying all bets are off, taxi drivers, you have to collect all this data, we've got no baseline to find out what's the system like today.
Yeah, you are identifying a source of frustration for among the task force, where we just do not have good, solid market data. There is some data that Eco Northwest discovered as part of their analysis, which was part of Eco Cab's application for a new taxi company permit.
So, colleagues, it seems to me it's really important for us to get this right. It's not necessarily important for us to do it fast. And to me, if we're going to do a pilot project, we need to get the baseline first, figure out that data collection, is it even feasible? Are all these things reasonable? Then do the pilot if we're going to move to it, so that we can see the difference.
Let me come just to the underlying question, Brian. What's the frequency with at which we would be allowed to ask for this aggregate data?
Monthly.
And so the penalties for not reporting data would kick in after the first month. And then you could go up the ladder, first, second, and third offense. At what point would the administrator, in this case the PBOT director, have the authority to revoke or suspend a license? Excuse me, permit.
So that does get into your next three questions. Why don't you dive into those?
So we can certainly revoke a permit, I think, reasonably after the third offense. And there's, you know, certainly disqualifying factors for, or there's certainly qualifying factors to revoke a permit for other noncompliance issues.
So just to play this out, it's the end of the first month, and PBOT requests data, a TNC fails to provide it, they get a notice of violation. Don't cure it, they get a second notice. Don't cure it, a third. At that point, they may be notified that they're at risk of having their permit revoked if they don't comply. Is that correct?
You could do it that way, or you could do it however, whatever we want. We're going to be writing the rules for the pilot program, and we could make it less than that if we were directed to do that way.
Okay. Great, and I think we've gotten through a bulk of the questions and issues that were identified last week. I think if council is open to it, we would like to extend an opportunity for TNCs and any other stakeholders
to... council members may have questions for TNCs, for cab companies, they're both here, or for task force members and staff. So sort of where would you like to start among those resource people that we have in the room?
And I believe we have somebody here from the Office of Equity and Human Rights, because I'd like to get their perspective on the equity and disability issues.
Mayor, I'd be interested in hearing from the TNCs, because okay. we're making some assumptions about compliance with some of these things, so maybe we can ask them directly.
Okay. Thank you all very much. A lot of excellent work. Good work. Okay, so let's have any of the TNC representatives who are here maybe come up and answer questions. Afternoon, welcome. So we're actually on the record here, even though this is informal, so that's why we need you to push the button. Actually talking, and it's a little awkward. The system will overload when two or three of us have our microphones on, as you've seen us demonstrate. So who's got the first question?
Hi, Commissioners. Mayor Hales, Caitlin O'Neill, Public Policy for Uber Technologies.
Hi, my name is Steve Seiger. I'm a policy counsel with Uber as well.
Hi, I'm Andrea Lobato. I'm the policy counsel and compliance counsel for Lyft.
Okay. Who's on first? Who's got a question?
Let's take the last question that we were kicking around, which is data, supplying certain aggregate data, and in addition, the requirement that each of you would be on a weekly basis be required to furnish the city with a list of your drivers so we can do compliance with business licenses. I guess first, Uber, is that a commitment you're prepared to make in both regards?
Thank you for the question. Yes, it is. So we're deeply concerned about protecting the privacy of our passengers and our drivers, but at the same time, we recognize that the data we have is of great value to a city like Portland. On the enforcement side, the provision of driver's lists, we completely understand the need for it and are prepared to share that data weekly.
Driver names.
Exactly, yes.
Full names, first and last.
I think we were considering first and last and a portion of a driver's license number or something along those lines.
Are you comfortable entering into a written agreement before a permit issues, clarifying that you have made that commitment?
Yes. It was my understanding that the intention was to impose it as a regulatory requirement. Separate from that, we understand that the city has a great deal of interest in our overall trip data. You may have heard we entered in an agreement with the City of Boston a few months back to share aggregate trip data because the city recognized that it was very useful to them in determining traffic flows, congestion, ability of transit, what areas of the city were served, and things of that nature. We were able to come to an agreement with them to share sort of aggregated, anonymized data to protect rider and driver privacy that still sort of showed how traffic flows were going over time. And again, we're prepared to enter into that sort of agreement with Portland as well.
Thank you. How about Lyft?
Thanks for the question. We are also prepared to enter into a similar type of agreement. We understand the needs of the city for gathering this data, and we also second Uber's need for protecting the privacy of our passengers and our drivers. So we're committed to sharing that data, especially under the provisions of a contract where we could agree to the privacy of that data.
Okay. Earlier you heard I think you were here to hear the exchange where Commissioner Novick made a point about how we could set standards of service for disabled passenger, which is something we also heard from the task force and earlier about maybe a better standard of measurement than just arbitrarily saying you have to have this many vehicles in your fleet, but instead establish a standard of service. What do you think of that as a concept, and how would we craft such a standard?
I think that, first of all, Uber shares a very deep commitment to providing, safe, reliable, affordable rides to everyone, every member of the community here in Portland. And so I think that our partnership with First Transit will be a great step in that direction. We've agreed, actually, to make Portland the first city in the world where we will have that partnership available on the app, where you can request a wheelchair-accessible vehicle from day one of launch here in Portland. And so based on the data that we'll be collecting during that pilot program, that will help us determine, I think, what a reasonable standard of service will look like, whether it's 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 15 minutes. That demand that we'll see through the app during that pilot period will help us better assess what that number exactly should look like.
So does First Transit actually have capacity to provide more rides, and how much?
We've been in constant contact with First Transit. I don't know exactly how much per se. That's probably something that we should ask them specifically. I do know from my conversations with them that the demand that they see for the wheelchair accessible vehicles that they have that's currently already in use, whether it's through Medicare trips or partnerships with nonprofit, tends to be more from 9 to 5 in the morning. And so we see a real opportunity there to be partnering with those providers on evenings and weekends in particular, so that we can make it available if somebody wants to go out to dinner, meet friends, have an on-demand option where they don't have to wait for 3 hours. So the partnership will exist at all times during the day, but we think that there's a real sweet spot there where they'll have the most availability that isn't already being used.
But just to be clear, you made a commitment that in terms of your pricing, there'll be a uniform pricing for both disabled passengers and able passengers. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Regardless of whatever the cost is to you to provide the third-party service.
That's correct.
Thank you. Lyft has also been in discussions with Ride Connection about providing accessible rides within the pilot period. This would be the first place that Lyft had ever had such a service similar to what Uber is suggesting, where you can actually book the wheelchair accessible ride through the app. And just to clarify, we're talking about mechanical wheelchairs. Lyft does accommodate foldable wheelchairs in most of our regular passenger vehicles. This would be for wheelchairs that required a ramp or a lift. And we're in talks with Ride Connection. We've heard from them that they do have capacity. They have about 100 vehicles that they could have at our disposal. And so we're in discussions with them, similar to what Uber had said. We will have the same pricing model for these accessible vehicles, and we would work out some sort of contract with Ride Connection directly.
I would also like to add that while our partnership with Ride Connection is very exciting and we'll have it launched and ready to go on day one, we're also extending an invitation to every wheelchair accessible taxi to be available on the app as well as our peer-to-peer ride sharing program, which allows us to partner with folks who have personal vehicles that have a wheelchair accessible feature. So the partnership and the availability for wheelchair accessible vehicles won't be solely through First Transit.
You've also heard some conversation among my colleagues about whether the insurance standards are sufficient in period one. And I think it would be helpful to hear from both of you about whether you are open, whether you would consider higher limits. And second, what are the barriers to those higher limits? Do you look at this as a cost factor, or do you see this as a risk factor? Or what are your considerations in terms of providing the additional coverage closer to what taxis do from you know, beginning to end?
Thank you for that question. It's a good one, and I understand that insurance is one of the more complicated areas of our business. As you heard from the city attorney, there are a couple of jurisdictions that have slightly higher limits during period one. Washington State is actually near a statewide bill that would change those limits to be very much in line with what we have before us today. There are actually some other jurisdictions across the country that are very much in line with the limits before us today, Colorado, Washington, D.C. I think it is becoming industry standard. And part of that reason is because of the agreement we and Lyft and Sidecar reached with the insurance industry about what the appropriate limits were to cover the risk. And the reason why period one is fundamentally different from periods two and three, again, that's the period where the app is on, but no ride has been accepted and there's no one in the car. The key difference there is that the driver, unlike a traditional taxi, is not driving around, looking both ways for street hails. To accept a trip on our app or on Lyft, you literally have to push a single finger on the app, and that's it. The ride is accepted. You need not even be driving at all at the time when a trip comes in. You can be sitting in a coffee shop. You can be at home with your kids. You could be parked on the side of the road. It just fundamentally is a different risk. It's not the same as sort of trolling for rides in the traditional taxi model. And for that reason, we think that the limits are appropriately lower.
Another issue.
System were both designed in 1895, so
we upgraded our technology and now nothing works. So you heard the council express concerns, and then our attorneys express concerns with provisions of a user agreement which we think may be unenforceable or illegal, or at the very least objectionable. I have not seen the Oregon counterpart for Uber's user agreement. And we all understand that sometimes lawyers get carried away putting exclusions and exemptions and disclaimers in these kinds of boilerplate agreements. But the stakes are a little higher here than typical user agreements because someone's getting in a vehicle and they could put themselves in some peril. So how do you react to what you've heard about particularly some of the concerns limiting liability, which may be inconsistent with state law, and disclaiming responsibility for safety and other features of the service that we've expressed concerns about that may or may not be in your Oregon user agreements?
I think I drew the straw on this one. So a couple of things. One, there's a blanket statement in our rider terms of service that explicitly make clear that these terms of service do not and cannot preempt underlying law, including the law of the city of Portland, including Oregon state law, including any federal law that would apply. Just so you know, the terms of service we have are nationwide terms of service. They're not designed for any particular state. And that's one of the reasons why the language is so broad. It's because different Supreme Courts of different states have different rules about what is and is not enforceable. So it's difficult to be exactly consistent with each state at the same time. Imagine I got off the plane today from San Francisco, and I probably clicked yes on the user agreement in San Francisco. I landed in Portland. It's a little bit difficult. There's one user agreement that applies sort of across the country. More generally, these are very similar to what you would find in any range of industries that are putting third-party providers in touch with consumers. You would see that in sort of online marketplaces or auction houses. You would see that in, you know, our taxi counterpart Curbs app. You know, the Portland Trailblazers through the NBA have an arbitration agreement on their website. The Portland City website has a limitation of liability for inaccuracies of information provided to the public.
That's because we never provide inaccurate information. So we were just stating the obvious.
My point is not to cast aspersions at all, but just to say this is really pervasive across the country, and I don't think we're out of line with the industry standard here at all.
What I would say just respectfully in response is, first of all, it's a user agreement that apparently through an app you acknowledge you've read. And my guess is it would take the average person on an iPhone 4 about a month to read that user agreement on their app, assuming they could get it up to the font they could read. And I guess the bigger concern is that when you do a generic nationwide agreement with some limited tailoring, and clearly you tailor them by state because you have rules of arbitration, venue, other kinds of things which are state-specific, what you may be inadvertently doing is discouraging people from exercising the rights that they have under state law. And I know that's not your intent, but what we don't want to do is be in a position where your user agreement is misleading your customers about rights they may have as any other consumer. And it may be simply, there may be some middle ground here about where the disclaimers are, the language you use. It's not exactly what I would call plain English, although if you've seen any of my writing recently, you'd probably say the same thing. But we might be able to put it in a more friendly version, and we also maybe, as you suggest, we may want to put into city code that notwithstanding anything in your user agreements, consumers in Portland are covered under Oregon law and all the protections that they have. The most important thing, though, is we don't want to discourage someone from pursuing a right or a claim they have because they've read a 20-page gobbledygook in a user agreement that's written in a very restrictive way.
I appreciate that. And the thing I should have added is that we're here considering the regulations that should apply to this industry. And what we ask is to put sensible rules into place and hold us to them. Put in place strong background check requirements, strong insurance requirements, vehicle inspection requirements, and put in place strong enforcement requirements so that you can hold us to it. That will supersede this agreement, and you know we will do everything we can to comply with the rules in place.
Thank you. I don't have too much to add, just that if there are these types of restrictions on TNCs, they should be the same restrictions on other types of companies. We just ask that TNCs not be singled out for these types of restrictions within contracts. And